FM News 106.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, although what we have to talk about first is the terrible, tragic, and deadly tragedy that happened over the weekend, the Independence Day weekend, in which more than 100 people, the current death toll out of Texas and especially in Kerr County, is more than 100, including a shocking number of children as well. And on the political side of that, it took about 10 seconds for many liberals in America to try to triangulate how President Donald Trump is to blame for floods that came from a record amount of rain falling out of the sky. Although it's a record amount that has happened a number of times in the last 100 years, so it is not beyond historic norms. But I want to talk about that with a guy who's up close and personal to it. He's Trey Ware, who's one of my fellow talk show hosts from our affiliate station, KTSA, in San Antonio. Hey, Trey, welcome to the program. Even under these circumstances, I wanted to be able to get somebody who's close to where all of this happened over the weekend.
Well, Lars, I know how much you love Texas, and I know for sure how much Texas loves Lars Larson, so it's an honor to be with you today.
Well, thank you for that. So we've got a couple of things, and I want to get to the firefighters union that is now saying some of their people, one of their departments in particular, was a little slow to get to help these people out. But this is something that the Guadalupe River is a river that has flooded, and flooded not on a regular basis, but it's not unusual to have flash floods on that river, is it?
No, it's not at all. In fact, if you go back to 1835, when they first started to keep records, you can see floods happening there. And I can tell you, Lars, as you know, I've been here my entire life, and I'm a motorcycle enthusiast, and that happens to be where I ride. I ride all up and down the Guadalupe River. And the way it is made, you have the hill country, which is just absolutely gorgeous, beautiful hills, rolling hills, peaks as well. And then you have the tributaries that run down into the Guadalupe River. The river itself, we've been in an extraordinary drought for a number of years, so it's been super dry in the river bed. So the dirt, the caliche, is extremely hard right now, and it's just not soaking up anything. Also, it's nothing but limestone rock all through there as well. And I'm talking about rock the size of a school bus, which is huge. And so when that water comes down that quickly in a what has been meteorologically termed a rain bomb because of the confluence of the remnants of Tropical Storm Barry, and then we already had a whole bunch of precipitation in the air. When it came together right over Kerr County, it just immediately popped, and down it all came at one time, ran into the Guadalupe River. It went from below its typical stage all the way up to 33 to 36 feet in just a matter of moments, and that's why it took so many people by surprise.
Well, and the question, though, I want to ask about is about these attempts to blame Trump. And they're saying, well, he's cut the National Weather Service and NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The cuts happened in October. It's not October yet, number one. But number two, didn't the Weather Service and the other folks put on extra folks and start sending out warnings, not the ultimate warnings that came early in the morning on the day of the flood, but the warnings the day before were we have flash flood conditions, right?
Yes, absolutely. Well, in fact, a week before on Sunday, they were already starting to say conditions are ripe for this type of activity to possibly happen. We can't tell you the exact location or pinpoint the exact location where it can happen, but this week, expect that kind of activity. They started for that out the prior Sunday. Then they were continually updating it as the week went on. As they got closer to the 4th of July weekend, then they brought in extra personnel to begin the warnings. This was just, and the people who are trying to second guess this right now ought to be ashamed of themselves. The people who are making a political football out of this right now should be ashamed of themselves. We still have children missing. We still have parents and grandparents missing right now. We have parents up there. We have grandparents up there that are searching for their children and grandchildren right now. Now is not the time. We'll have plenty of time to revisit this later and try to decide if there's something that could have been done differently. But as we said, you know, we have a saying here in the state of Texas. You're very familiar with it. If you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes. It's going to change. And stuff can change on a dime. And, Lars, we go from feast to famine. We go from famine to feast. And that's exactly what happened here. Years of a drought, and then all of a sudden that drought is erased in a matter of hours. And it just so happened it was the 4th of July. There were a lot of people that were camping on the river. Plus you had the summer camps for the kiddos.
Yep.
And it happened in the middle of the night. So most of them were asleep. They didn't get the notifications at 1 a.m. that this was going on, the other notifications that continued to come out, because they were asleep. What woke them up was the raging Guadalupe River. There's nothing anybody could have done to prevent that. Could there have been different warnings, or maybe a more advanced warning or sirens or something? Possibly. And that's what we look at a later time after we get through with the recovery mission that's going on right now. We have hundreds of people up there now, Lars, who are trying to find
bodies. And they are.
That's what
they're in a recovery. They want to find these missing children. And by the way, there's one hocus-pocus story that some idiot posted saying some children have been rescued 30 feet out of a tree. That turns out to be 100% false. It might have given people, you know, some hope or something like that. But this, I hate it when people post stuff on social media. You and I have been radio, though, for decades. We've always been part of the broadcast system. It used to be called EBS. Now it's the emergency notification system. Was that used? Because I've been in places where my phone goes off and everybody around me who has a phone, the phone goes off and it says there may be flash floods. I've had that happen. Was that used?
It's very possible it was, and I'm not sure if it was or wasn't, but even if it was, I can tell you from being in that area quite a lot, cell service is spotty. It's in the Texas Hill Country. In some of the camps where the kiddos are, they don't have their cell phones with them because they want them to be more focused on other stuff, you know, so they check their cell phones in. Of course, the camp counselors have cell phones, and they're in contact, but there's only so much you can do. And I understand people wanting to figure out what happened, but the political game, you mentioned the story about somebody being rescued up in a tree. There are all kinds of stories of people on the internet who are contacting these parents and saying, we have found your child. If you'll send us money, we will send your child back to you. Oh. We have a pediatrician in the Houston area.
Oh, she got fired, right?
She did. She said that this is, you know, you deserve this and the children deserve it. Imagine a pediatrician saying that children deserve to die because their parents voted for Trump. So you see the best in people and the worst in people. We have so many people, thousands of people up there right now who are working on the recovery efforts. We have the Cajun Navy up there. We have that Coast Guard member who swam to rescue 170 children. There's so many heroes. Let's focus on them. Let's talk about them.
Yeah, absolutely. And the only, and I don't think we'll have time to get to it, but I guess Austin Firefighters Union is very angry. Their chief didn't immediately have them heading out the door because they specialize in swift water rescue, but I'll deal with that another time. Trey, thank you. Anything else for people to think about other than a thought and a prayer for our friends
in
Texas? That's
it. For the people across America, just pray for us here in Texas. We need all the prayers you can give us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That is Trey Ware from our affiliate station, KTSA, in San Antonio. Glad to be with you on a Tuesday. We'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk.
Be honest. You're listening because you like what you hear. Right? Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, here's an interesting irony. We just got done celebrating Independence Day in America. Independence from what? A tyrannical government. Well, consider this. The government in Oregon, and specifically ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation, have decided to retaliate against citizens after state lawmakers, both Democrats and Republicans, denied the agency cash from what would have been the biggest tax increase in history. That is inexcusable. For a state agency to retaliate against the clients that it has, the citizens of the state, Republican lawmakers had proposed a plan that would have preserved basic ODOT services with no new taxes. Democrats refused to support it. Democrats hold supermajorities in the legislature, and even they couldn't get the votes for their plan for that historic tax increase. So what does ODOT do? As you're hearing on the news, senior positions, that means the white-collar bureaucrats, will be preserved. So white-collar paper pushers get to keep their jobs. But hundreds of worker bees at ODOT get the axe. And ODOT is not shy about its threats. They say if the forests catch fire, ODOT assistance in evacuation, that's been cut. Snow plowing in the winter, forget about it. Potholes, don't expect repairs. Maintenance workers and bridge inspectors take the hit instead of the folks sitting in the corner offices. And the same six-figure administrators who made that billion-dollar budget boo-boo, the one that flooded ODOT with red ink within the last year and a half or so, they get to keep their fat salaries, and the folks who actually do the work on the front line get to get a pink slip. Imagine if you were working for a private company and workers told the boss, if we don't get what we want, boss, we're going to make your customers suffer. Pink slips would fly in the private sector. Oregon's cowardly Governor Tina Kotek simply doesn't have the backbone to do what's right. Our question of the day, and this one's brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Lars, so my wife works for an agency in delivering operations. We were talking about the cuts, and I bring up the DEI office, and why wasn't that cut out? She believes they're required to have that office, and although she can't tell me if it's a law or something else, I'm going to guess it's a Kate Brown executive order and not a state statute that requires a DEI office. Funny how their $30 million fantasy fund is a wall between probably 300 individuals continuing to have a job. Any idea where the requirement might come from? I'll do my best to find out, but ODOT doesn't talk to the press these days. My favorite post on X today, four more violent Portland Antifa riot suspects have been federally charged. Three of them are facing serious felony charges. The four are accused of violently rioting at a 4th of July direct action where the local Portland area ICE facility was besieged once again. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you
ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to a pastor whose name I do not know, but I got this note from Bill. At church yesterday, on Sunday, 2 days ago, our minister spoke about the negativity of Trump's big, beautiful bill, that it hurts Medicare, food banks, and immigrants. I spoke briefly with him after the service and asked why so many help wanted signs all over and could not get a clear answer. But he did say immigrants afraid to work as they might be kidnapped by ICE. What's your take on Trump's big, beautiful bill? Before I get to that big, beautiful bill, that is not a man of God. That pastor, the pastor that's using his pulpit for political purposes, that's dead wrong, number one. Number two, about the big, beautiful bill. What is the pastor talking about? That it hurts Medicaid, not Medicare. Medicaid is for the poor. Medicare is for the elderly. But in terms of Medicaid, Trump's bill will cut millions of people out of Medicaid. Who are those people? They are in three groups. Number one, illegal aliens who have no right to be in the country to begin with. They are cut from Medicaid. They should be. And if somebody wants to be a naysayer today and tell me why they shouldn't be cut, then I'd be glad to hear the argument. Number two, deadbeat Americans. And by that, I mean, here's how I define deadbeat: a working age childless adult, not a child, not the elderly, and not somebody with disabilities, a working age childless adult. If you want to stay on Medicaid, you have to work at least 20 hours a week or be in a training program that leads to a job. They're being cut from Medicaid, and they should be. Again, I'll listen to naysayer arguments if you want to make one of those naysayer arguments. The third group that gets cut from Medicaid under the big, beautiful bill, well, that would be doctors who sexually mutilate children with both knives and drugs, and they're getting cut from Medicaid, and they should be. Once again, naysayers welcome on that. Today's best email brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I've seen it with my own eyes. They did it for me. It makes a beautiful place to relax with family and friends. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com. Now, John in Spokane writes in, Lars, apparently Washington State thinks it can keep track of what they call microaggression against illegals and trans folks. The state set up a hotline for this category of people to call so they can complain if somebody says something they might find offensive. I'm not rude to people, but I think this is a hotline for whiners who get offended too easily. Mainly it's pure censorship and leads a trail for possible future harassment of people who might have been mean or rude but didn't break any laws. Our taxes now pay for a system of record-keeping against people who've hurt other people's feelings? And where's the proof of these verbal attacks? And the left calls our side Nazis. This is straight from the Gestapo. I think it's unconstitutional. I think it needs to be stopped. And John, I think you're absolutely right. Let me go first to Debbie. Hey, Debbie, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes, sir. I'm calling to just let you know, thank you so much for providing a platform. We appreciate you.
Thanks. I'm glad to do it.
Yeah, thank you. Regarding the land in Oregon, you know, and all the different things and changes they're trying to make, you know, they've already closed a percentage of our forests, a percentage of our rivers, lakes, and streams. They don't even want the jet boats in southern Oregon. They don't want the fishermen at the Gulf of the Rogue, you know, or at the ocean. And then I also...
Debbie, I'm not used. You told the producer you're going to talk about, but if you want to talk about that, and who is the they that is closing down all those public lands to the public? You want to tell me?
It is definitely it's the Democratic Party, and it's like the governor up, you know, our governor.
The governor and the federal government, not under Trump. Trump wants to open those lands up. So when we trust the government to manage public lands, and then the government locks the public, their clients, out of the lands, what should we make of that?
Yes, sir. Yes, and, you know, they have us locked out of our forest. So when the event comes up for us that, like, something happened in Texas, I understand it can't be exactly the same, but we're going to have our event, too. And when we're locked out of a percentage of our forest and everything else, we're even more subject. And you are correct, sir. I did want to talk about one other thing.
Well, the problem is, Debbie, I'm up against the clock, but we'll talk. And to answer your question, as far as I can see, there is no gun seizure in Texas because of the flooding. There was seizure of guns after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. But then again, New Orleans was a state under Democrat control and a Democrat mayor of the city who decided to violate the Constitution. He seized citizen guns that were held legally, and the court slapped him down later on. But by then, it was too late. So that's your answer. No guns seized in Texas.
The Lars Larson Show. Simply by listening, you're proving how smart you really are. Lars thanks you.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, to paraphrase a politician from days long, long ago, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you're talking about real money. And just a moment ago, I was talking about the fact that ODOT made a billion-dollar boo-boo by overestimating its revenue coming in. Kind of like if you wrote in twice as much money into your checking account as you actually get from your paycheck, and then you just spent on the basis that you had twice as much money. They made that kind of billion-dollar mistake. Well, there's another billion-dollar mistake that they're attempting to pawn off on the public, and this one involves the biggest public works project in the Northwest right now, and that is the replacement of the Interstate Bridge over the Columbia River from Oregon to Washington on Interstate 5. And John Lee is the guy, state representative and retired pilot, who actually spotted this attempted scam. John, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, thanks for having me on. Happy post-4th of July, and we're all celebrating the big, beautiful bill.
that passed. But yes, there's so many things happening in the world of transportation here that happy to run down several of these things for you and your listeners.
Well, let's talk about this, because you and I have talked about the fact that they want to add 2 miles of light rail that will run from the Expo Center in Oregon on the Oregon side over to 0.9 miles into the state of Washington. And we've said it's $2 billion and it's 2 miles. So it's $1 billion a mile. And yet there's an attempt to try to say that this does not add $2 billion of cost to the interstate bridge.
Well, they're constantly playing games with this. And there was an interesting public records request that I got here, where the program told the Federal Transit Administration that to build the actual bridge component of it, that cost was $1 billion, $1.021 billion, which is amazing in and of itself. So they're talking a $7.5 billion project, and only $1 billion of it is the bridge. Subtle hint number one, they're burying and hiding lots of ridiculous things in it. A different aspect of that was that the transit component of that, they said, was 16%, or roughly $166 million. And so, again, that shows, I believe, the cost of the tracks and things that are being laid in it. But they don't go into details. But so much of this is smoke and mirrors, where they're hiding money. But at the end of the day, they're asking the federal government to pony up half of the $2 billion transit component of this $7.5 billion project. And it makes no sense for any of us to ask our taxpayers, either at the state or the federal level, to pony up this kind of money, because nobody is riding mass transit anymore.
No, well, and when you say nobody, the numbers are down dramatically. They've had declining numbers in Seattle. They've had declining numbers in Portland on TriMet. And you've pointed out before that Clark Transit, has had a very small number of people riding their express buses, which follow the same path as the light rail is going to follow. And they're saying that's, what, 500 people a day, and they say they're going to boost that to tens of thousands?
Yeah, exactly right. Greg Johnson and his team are projecting 26 to 33,000 people or boardings on every day just on the I-5 corridor. And currently you're seeing about 500 boardings, which, assuming a person boards twice a day, that's 250 people that are no longer riding their cars or whatnot. It's ridiculous to spend potentially $2 billion for that kind of a massive light rail project in search of a bridge.
Okay, and in terms of hiding the money, John, I just want to make sure I understand this right. They only want to count the tracks and other light rail garbage that they put on the bridge itself, but not the tracks that come to the bridge or the tracks that go from the bridge into Vancouver. So they want to say, oh, those don't count because they're not actually part of the bridge?
Well, and so this is an interesting discussion in that they're asking the Federal Transit Administration to let them spend money, and they can't spend the money for the other components of that for a couple years. In a sense, you have certain metrics you have to cross, and they haven't crossed those metrics, so they can't spend the money to buy the light rail vehicles, to do the expansion of the transit station at Expo, or build the transit station in Vancouver, or the transit station 80 to 90 feet above the ground. So what they are asking permission for is for, just in designing the bridge, can you let us spend some of the money for the design of the bridge portion only right now, and then they'll ask for the rest of it later. It gets very convoluted.
Well, and here's the thing, John. ODOT is broke right now. They're so broke, they're telling folks, well, we're going to lay off 600 people now. We may lay off hundreds more next year. We're out of money. We can't plow snow. We can't help out with fire evacuation. We can't do any of that stuff. Don't expect any of it. But they're going to have what? Their component, their half of maybe $4 billion. So ODOT is going to somehow come up with $2 billion, and they're flat bust right now.
Yeah, there is so much wrong in this. The Oregon legislature, even though they didn't pass the transportation package, which you noted was the largest transportation tax increase in the history of Oregon, even though they didn't pass that, they did allocate $250 million out of the general fund that could have spent on any number of things that Oregon citizens really want, but they allocated that $250 million for the IBR to keep Greg Johnson afloat and keep this
now, hold on. So John, do I understand this right? They took money they could have spent on regular day-to-day operations of ODOT, which is the entire highway system that serves 90,000 square miles of Oregon, and they parked it over in an account to be spent on a bridge that I think you and I have both discussed is probably a dead project right now because of federal funding, because of Coast Guard approval, because of opposition to light rail and everything else. But they parked the money where ODOT can't use it for the day-to-day needs of citizens, but will have it there for a bridge that may never actually be built?
Exactly right. And that was unbelievable and I think serves the Oregon citizens so, so poorly.
By the way, John, you know that I try to do my due diligence. I mean, sometimes I succeed and sometimes I don't. But I sent notes to IBR. I said, I want to talk to Greg Johnson. I've got some questions for him. And they said, Mr. Johnson will not agree to an interview. He will, however, take your written questions. And the problem with written questions is, and I've done this before, I don't submit questions in advance because then the person you're seeking to interview just simply says, well, I'm not going to answer those. Or they answer them in the way they want to, which would require a follow-up, only you can't follow up in a text, you know, Q&A. So, you know, the end result is Johnson doesn't want to talk about this. And I think it's because he's got a big, fat job with a big, fat six-figure paycheck on a project that is already a dead man walking, and he doesn't want to talk about it because he doesn't have answers for all this. Would you find any fault with that argument?
Not at all. And a different aspect of this was that because Oregon didn't pass their transportation package, TriMet didn't get their huge statewide payroll tax increase. They were seeking that 200% increase in the head tax.
Yep.
They didn't get that, and they're threatening to cut 10% of their light rail service as well as 27% of their bus service. Well, that is a not so subtle hint that there is no demand. They can't even afford to maintain their current service.
Doesn't make any sense, does it? That's John Lee, state representative, retired airline pilot, and a reporter for Clark County Today. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And is there a political motivation behind a major Seattle shooting over the weekend? Even with...
Just think of him as your concealed carry. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Around 3 a.m., neighbors in Ballard woke up to a barrage of gunfire.
That's from Como News up in Seattle, where over the weekend in Ballard, and specifically on Sunday morning, there were multiple gunshots that were fired into a home. And the Seattle Police Department says the house was potentially targeted due to political and ideological signs in the window of residence. It clearly was politically motivated. The woman who has the signs up has Donald Trump signs, a number of them, a thin blue line Police Lives Matter sign, and a sign with a Confederate flag. The homeowner told Como News, didn't want to be named, and I understand that pride flag stickers had been placed on her vehicle during that incident. Seattle police say the vehicle had bullet damage, along with the stickers that reflected the suspect's own political or social ideology. That probably means they'll never be caught, because that seems to be the way things go these days. Take a listen to what the woman said who lives in the home.
I'm scared. I was shaking. And I think I'm going to move.
Seattle police say no one was injured in the shooting. The homeowner did not want to go on camera, but told Como News she believes she's being targeted because of her political and personal beliefs, as the home had pro-Trump signs and a Confederate flag in the window.
In the window. Now, I got to tell you something. The political violence seems to be amping up. You could really take it back to the summer of last year. The attempted assassination of Donald Trump, number one. Attempted assassination, number two. At least two or three other plots that we know of. The country of Iran behind some of them. And then, of course, other political violence that has happened over the last year and a half or so as Donald Trump won, ran successfully to run for president of the United States. Glad to have you with me. Glad to take your calls, too. If you want to jump into the best conversation and talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And this segment of the show comes from 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540training.com. Let me go first to Hartman. Hey, Hartman, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yes, how are you doing?
Quite well, sir. Happy Independence Day after. So.
Listening to the ODOT problem, it seems like that they ended up coming out here and pulling money for to put new sidewalks in for Burns. And most of the people here did not vote that, and they're kind of pissed off at it because other things could have been done with that money, like a lithium refinery.
Well, I'm not sure that you could have taken ODOT money to spend it on a lithium refinery because I don't know that you could transfer the money that far. But frankly, I don't think we need to pay for a lithium refinery. What we need to do is clear the federal regulations so a private company can do it because lithium, of course, is used in batteries and all kinds of other things. So a private company would be happy to do it if America didn't have such insane levels of regulation. But as far as ODOT goes...
would be, you know, Elon Musk and that type of work. The Indians have a certain amount of lithium, but they're also environmental friendly, and it has taken me 3 years to get past some of their hurdles to do production for lithium, and they're open-minded for it. So
and on their reservation, would they be held to the federal regulations or only to the regulations of their sovereign nation? Do you know?
Only to the regulations of their sovereign nation.
That's what I thought.
Again, I mean, you have heavy equipment out there and you're needing to do maintenance on it. They're not going to want the hydraulic oil to be just let go and do your job and move on.
Hydraulic oil costs a lot of money. You don't want to spill any of it either, do you?
It does. No, you don't. And with the production of electricity and the way that it needs to be transferred over from petroleum to electric is a huge concern. And that's why I kind of emailed you that last night, and I thank you for reaching out to me.
I'm glad to do it because, look, this country should be producing its own rare earths and things like copper and lithium and everything else. And at every turn, the Biden administration blocked mines, blocked territory. There's a huge area for mining uranium that is outside of the Grand Canyon National Monument or National Park area. And Biden locked it up in another national monument. And there was no good reason for it. We could have seen a lot of that produced. It would have been not just generating jobs and tax revenue, but it would have made America even more energy independent since Hillary Clinton sold our uranium.
Or timberjacks, you know, it was nice to know that my job was there in the morning. And somehow that has been left with paper mills that's over in Washoe will be knocked down to concrete. I mean, these people had the resources to put back to help citizens to get off their feet or to be out of poverty.
That's absolutely right, and I appreciate the call. Let's go to Kenny. Kenny, we got about a minute till the break. What's on your mind?
Hey there, Lars. Hey, is there a possibility that the Trump administration wouldn't fund this these billions for the bridge?
Yeah. There's a very strong possibility. We've been trying to get Transpose Secretary Duffy to come on the program and talk to us because we want to ask him, are you going to pour billions of dollars, federal money, into a bridge that's a disaster? It's a disaster for the waterway. It's opposed because of light rail. It's being built smaller effectively than the current bridge. more than 50% of the bridge deck is dedicated to pedestrians, bicycles, and light rail trains, and less than 50% to cars and trucks. I mean, if we can tell the transportation secretary that, why in the world would he put a single dime of the federal government's money in there? Back in a moment. Glad to be with you on a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.
15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. I want to talk about whether or not skin color should give you a special in when it comes to going to a public university. Now, this has been a problem for a while because we've had efforts at so-called affirmative action, which is simply a different kind of bigotry that might have been practiced in America than the kind that was practiced in America maybe 70 years ago. And yet, there are people who believe that it's okay. In fact, quite some time ago, back in the 80s, the U.S. Supreme Court said a little bit of affirmative action was okay. The problem is that has now grown to something that during the Biden years, thank God they're over, we had DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. We had CRT, critical race theory, and a lot of other nonsense that ended up with both private and public universities biasing against white students, against Asian students, and in favor of black American students and black Hispanic American students. And that makes no sense to me. So I thought we'd talk to Matt Lamb about it. He's the associate editor at the College Fix. And about the history of one particular academic program manager who had a history of literally prioritizing non-white students. Matt, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on.
Tell my audience about Jeff Chamberlain.
Jeff Chamberlain is the academic program manager at the University of Oregon. Before he worked there, he was at the Honors College at Grand Valley State University and then the Honors College at the University of North Florida. According to emails obtained by the College Fix, when he was the director of the Grand Valley State University Honors College, which is in Michigan, the school began privileging, quote, students of color for admissions and scholarships. So the College Fix obtained emails from a source where the current director of the Honors College says, we accept virtually all students of color. We privilege them for admissions and scholarships. And he says, this has been going back to Dr. J, which is not the basketball player, but Jeff Chamberlain.
Now, hold
and
on.
He was there from 2000. Sorry.
I didn't mean to interrupt your story, but is that legal?
It's not legal, and so this email is from April 2022. Students for Fair Admissions, which was the Supreme Court decision that affirmed that you cannot discriminate on the basis of race in higher education, came out in 2023. However, when Jeff Chamberlain was at Grand Valley State beginning in 2007, affirmative action was already illegal in Michigan because of a law called Prop 2, which passed in 2006. Which banned affirmative action. So it was illegal under federal law, and the university should have known. In fact, they did know that affirmative action was illegal in 2006 because in 2023, and sorry, you know, I'm throwing a lot of years at you now.
I know.
In 2023, when the affirmative action decision came out, the president of the university, Philomena Mantella, said, we do not discriminate on the basis of race. We have not privileged students since 2006. Because of Michigan law, and that apparently that is not true. And apparently, at least sometime in 2017 or earlier, they were privileging black students and other non-white students for admissions and scholarships.
Okay, so is there any reason to believe that Jeff Chamberlain, now, as you said, the academic program manager at the University of Oregon in Eugene, has changed his stripes at all?
No, I tried reaching him. I actually did get him on the phone, but he declined to comment. And so I think it would be worth looking into what role he played at the University of North Florida and if they implemented a similar program. I don't know, but I would hope that perhaps the Department of Justice or Department of Education, might look further into these situations.
Well, is there... Look, we've already talked about the fact that it's not legal, and you and I have known that for a long, long time. I mean, it's against federal law, it's against state laws, it's against the U.S. Constitution, because everybody gets equal treatment. And all three of the places this guy taught were public universities, were they not?
Correct. They were all public universities, but even private universities were bound by the Civil Rights Act,
right,
because they receive federal funding.
But all I'm saying is that the reason I point out the fact that they're public is that under the 14th Amendment, all of us have the right to equal treatment under the law. Well, if you go to a state institution and you say, I would like to go to school here, and they say, you can't come in because you have white skin, but that guy or that gal can come in because she has black skin or brown skin, you're not being treated equally under the law, are you?
Exactly. And the school cannot even claim that they just perhaps added one extra seat for a low-performing student, because as this email from Roger Gillis, who was the successor to Jeff Chamberlain at Grand Valley States, he says, we've tried hard to give most of the limited number of honor-specific scholarships we award to students of color. So there was a very small, there was a small pot of scholarships. This is according to the Grand Valley State University administrator, and they've tried very hard, going back to Dr. J's time, Jeff Chamberlain's time, to privilege non-white students for these scholarships. That could have included a student who had an 880 SAT score, according to this email.
That's now, what, half of the possible numbers you get. It's been a long time since I took the SAT.
Yes, so I actually looked up at Grand Valley State in fall 2022. There was only 51 students who scored lower than a 900 on the SAT. And it seems very, at least one was accepted into the Honors College, and it seems very possible that that student was awarded a scholarship. Again, just taking these people at their own word.
Does Jeff Chamberlain in those emails say anything about what he thinks justifies this?
So he is not on the emails. What it is someone at the university saying, when Jeff Chamberlain was here, they call him Dr. J, we've been privileging students of color for admissions and scholarship.
I guess I just have a tough time believing that if that's known to the administrators of the college, and let's say the board of trustees, whoever the board of directors of the college is, that they said, yeah, that's okay, we can go ahead and bias against white students and in favor of students of color.
Well, bro, that's the thing. They definitely know now. In fact, I know that the attorneys at the college have known about this since April, because I filed a Freedom of Information Act request to verify the authenticity of these emails. And curiously, they redacted the juiciest parts of the emails where they talk about discrimination. So the attorney, at least the counsel for the university, has known at least since April, because she read the email, saw it, and I think thought, well, that doesn't look good on us. Let me take a black marker and cross it off. Also, in their zeal to redact what should be public information, they actually redacted the public email addresses of professors, which anyone could go look up now. So they were so zealous about hiding things that they clearly broke the law with FOIA law, in addition, obviously.
And by the way, they can't just redact it at will. They have to have a reason. And I would imagine saying, well, if we release these public documents to the public, the members of the public might sue us. I don't think that's one of the exceptions. Matt, thanks very much. Matt is the associate editor with the College Fix. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get you your phone calls and your email at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. When it comes time.
Saying the things you wish you could say. More with with Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, American liberals took about 10 seconds to decide that the deadly floods in Texas could be blamed on President Donald Trump. And it is horrific what happened over the weekend. You had deadly flooding in Texas, a Christian youth camp. Was hit particularly hard. About 700 kids were there. 20 of the people there, both children and some of the camp counselors, perished in that flood. The death toll continues to mount. It is now well over 100. And yet the crazy stuff that came out of the mouths of liberals who couldn't just think, we need to reach out a hand and help out or at least pray for the people who are beset by these floods. The floods were crazy. I mean, 15 to 20 in some places, inches of rain falling in a few hours, a river that went up by about 29 feet in the span of 2 hours. So you can imagine the flooding came fast. It was a true flash flood. And apparently people did not get the warning signs, even though the National Weather Service had warned of flood conditions a week before the floods and then gave specific warnings the day before the floods on Thursday. And then on 4th of July, you had the floods that began very, very early in the morning. And so I'm sure there will be people second guessing all over the place about should there have been warning sirens. Those communities that actually talked about it but decided they didn't want to go to the expense. They wanted to stick with the system they had, which was both the phone messages and text messages, that if somebody upriver saw the river rising quickly, that they would notify people who are downriver. But already the kind of insanity, let me give you one example. But first, I want to invite you to the program. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, happens here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, you know, you disagree with me, we're glad to have you. For more than 25 years, we've always said naysayers go to the head of the line. So 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Oh, and by the way, our X poll today, because we post a brand new poll question every day. Should President Trump bow to pressure from farmers and grant amnesty to many illegal aliens to serve the agricultural community? My answer to that is a big, fat no. And in fact, I think Donald Trump's position on the issue is being mischaracterized by people who don't like Trump. And believe me, the blue staters, they hate Trump with a passion. But imagine this. You had Dr. Christina Probst. Her day job is as a pediatrician, a doctor for children. And what did she post online? Well, she's deleted the post, but it was there. May all visitors, children, and non-MAGA voters and pets be safe and dry. Kerr County MAGA voted to gut FEMA. They deny climate change. Maybe they got what they voted for. Bless their hearts. Well, Dr. Christina Probst, the pediatrician, is now looking for a new job because she's been fired. But she wasn't the only one. Consider George Stephanopoulos, I call him Snuffleupagus, on ABC over the weekend. He said that there were staffing shortfalls at the National Weather Service, again, blamed on Trump, because Trump's new budget cuts back the National Weather Service by 10%. But the cuts hit in October. And in fact, they had extra staff on hand as they knew that there were flood conditions last week, well before the 4th of July. And then on CNN, the Chicken Noodle News Network, consider what Dana Bash said. She was talking to a union official to talk about Donald Trump's buyouts, where they let federal employees go by offering them money to quit their jobs, had left Texans unprepared, even though Democrat Representative Joaquin Castro said, no, there's no conclusive evidence that that happened. But the fact is, last October, Bash, the same person, was slamming Laura Trump for criticizing the Biden-Harris FEMA after Hurricane Helene, calling it dangerous politics. And yet, when it comes to Donald Trump, I guess dangerous politics are okay. But you've had a tremendous number of crazy people, like Sade Perkins. Sade Perkins had called Camp Mystic, that's one of the Christian youth camps that was very hard hit. She called it a white-only girls Christian camp. That is specifically and categorically not true. She also said no one would care if the kids were minorities. They only cared because the kids who died were white. This is coming from people involved in politics. She's a former mayoral appointee from the city of Houston. So you've got all these people saying all these crazy things. For example, the Democrats, wrongly suggesting that Team Trump had slowed the disaster response. Representative Julian Castro and Chuck Schumer were both raging about the National Weather Service cuts. As I said, those cuts don't become effective until October the 1st. So how in the world could cuts that are coming, you know, 5 months from now have had an effect on whether or not the Weather Service had actually forecast what was going to happen? And consider this, that on Thursday of last week, the National Weather Service had sent out major storm warnings Thursday afternoon on, and saying that a catastrophic label is what they put on the warning that came at 1:14 a.m. Friday, hours before the flooding began. And then around 5 o'clock, they actually issued another warning. Sorry, 4 a.m., they declared a flash flood emergency. So there were hours of warning if you were in a position to actually get those warnings. Some of those towns around the Guadalupe River were supposed to have the kind of siren system that you have in tornado territory. This is actually known, an area known as Flash Flood Alley. And there's a gentleman who really focuses on meteorologists named Chris Martz. And he says there were major floods of the Guadalupe River going all the way back to 1838, almost 200 years ago, 1869, 1906, 21, 32, 36, 52, 78, 87, and 1998. So the end of a Tropical Storm Barry, had dumped about 20 inches of rain in a short period of time. And the thing is, though, if you say, well, that's historic, that's never happened before. No, the National Weather Service documents that 20 times in the last 100 years, 20 times there have been events that dropped 15 inches or more of rain on the interior of the state of Texas. So they also point out that there has been no trend in increasing in maximum one-day precipitation totals since 1895. So anybody who tells you this is all about climate change, well, they're just full of baloney. So glad to be with you. Let me go first to Bob. Hey, Bob, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I'll be brief. The other day you were talking with Zybeck regarding forest management.
Yeah.
And you mentioned there were billions of dollars of timber being wasted. I'm just here to give you a solid number on that. It's between the assumption that prior to the Northwest Forest Plan, using policies and practices in effect prior to that, the amount of timber not being cut in Region 6, Oregon, Washington, is between 50 and 74 billion.
Your phone is starting to cut out on me, Bob. I can't hear it. You said 13 and 24. Is it 13 and 24 billion board feet? I believe it. And the number is, but the important thing is you can fix this problem by going out and cutting trees down, turn them into lumber, and replanting the trees. It's one of the best renewable resources anywhere. And you would think, and thank you for the call, Bob, you would think that the environmental community, who are always talking about sustainability, well, regrowing trees is very sustainable. It is one of the most ultimate sustainable resources in existence on planet Earth. And the fact is, not cutting them down and letting them burn or die because of disease or bugs is colossally stupid. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news. Informed and always guessing what he'll say next. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I hope you all had a wonderful Independence Day weekend, but I'm very concerned about what's going on in this country lately. You've had ICE offices, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that have been laid siege by mobs of people, many of whom, because they're doing it in sanctuary states, don't face any kind of retribution from the law or enforcement of the law. And then over the weekend in Seattle, there was a woman whose home was shot up, and it appears the motivation was she had some Trump signs in her windows. She also had some signs that talked about making America great again. She also had a Confederate flag, but whether you like that or not, it certainly doesn't justify putting bullet holes in the side of her house. A lot of political violence. So I thought we'd talk to Danielle Alvarez, who's a senior advisor for the RNC, about whether or not liberals are deliberately driving a lot of this political violence. Danielle, welcome back.
It's great to be on with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with that first short generic question. Are the Democrats and liberals, members of the Democrat Party, deliberately driving this kind of violence because they know what's going to happen when they make some of the public statements they've made?
You know, I think it's kind of gone too far for the left. You know, I remember during the 2022 midterm cycle, you know, you would hear Maxine Waters shouting, saying, take it to the streets. They can't feel wrecked. There was one example I remember, I can't remember if it was Maxine Waters or another Democrat who said, you know, they can't find peace even when they're, you know, sitting having a meal. And unfortunately, the very radical left, I don't think that this is every Democrat because, you know, I hope that we can find civility and unity in our nation. I think that that's really what President Trump is trying to strive for. But I think that the very radical left has gone too far. I was reading this article in Axios where, you know, their members who are Democrat members who are going to town halls in their districts and the violent language being used by their constituents. I mean, there's constituents that are suggesting that, you know, these members of Congress have to be willing to get shot. They have to be willing, you know, it's not good enough. You need to be, quote, there needs to be blood to grab the attention of the press and the public. That is absolutely unhinged.
I think it is, too. And, Danielle, one example just from this last weekend of the terrible flood tragedy in Texas has already taken over 100 lives. There was a lady pediatrician, I mean, a lady whose job is to take care of kids in medicine. And she came out and, you know, basically said these kids and their families got what they voted for and that she wished well all of those who were non-MAGA. And I thought, This is a doctor. This isn't some guy, you know, some blue collar liberal sitting over a beer at a bar just shouting his lungs out. This is a lady who's supposed to be relatively smart. And she said that. Now she got fired for it. But I'm just wondering, you know, do they realize what they're calling for when they say, let's take it to the streets and or Chuck Schumer warning the Supreme Court, literally, you will reap the whirlwind.
You know, I think that's the very unfortunate thing is that, you know, this violent language, it crossed the line to violent and in some cases simply bordered on violent from Democrat elected officials, you know, has caused their base. And again, I certainly don't want to say every Democrat because that wouldn't be fair, but has caused some individuals in their base, the very extreme members of their base, to take this stance, to say, you know, that they got what they were asking for in Texas. That is horrific. You know, I just, these individuals who are now attacking ICE agents for doing their job, you know, my husband is formerly a law enforcement officer. I can't imagine him going to work and facing that type of pressure. You know, I really pray for these law enforcement and ICE agents who are putting their life on the line every single day. I don't think that there is space, a place for this type of violence and this type of rhetoric. I think that it is unfortunate because I truly believe it stemmed from these Democrat elected leaders and then has just spiraled out of control with the very extreme members of their base. And then I would remind anyone listening now that what this ultimately resulted in was two assassination attempts against President Trump. I worked on his campaign. I was a senior advisor to the communication shop during his campaign. I dealt with that first horrific shooting at Butler where we lost the life of a great patriot, Corey Comparatore, where President Trump was shot, where I was worried that my friends and my colleagues there, you know, weren't okay. And then, of course, the second assassination attempt on the president while the president was golfing on the golf course in Palm Beach. I mean, we really need to take the temperature down and we need to remember that we have more that unites us than divides us. And that this president is doing this and and focused on things that the majority of the country, the 80% plus of the country, believes in.
Yep.
Peace across the globe, economic prosperity, a secure border, bringing down crime. I mean, when you look at the polling and the numbers, that's why I say I don't think it's every Democrat, and I don't want to paint the entire Democrat Party in this picture, but I certainly lay the blame at the feet of Democrat elected officials who have gone way too extreme, and now we're seeing it turn back on them and the way that the base is reacting.
Well, you may find this an odd comparison, but Danielle, I heard somebody just the other day bemoaning the fact we've got too much division in the country. And I said, actually, I started thinking about it. And I thought, I think the Democrats are worried that we don't have enough division. And here's why. Because when Trump came in, he gives his what would have been a State of the Union address, but technically it wasn't. And at the end of that, all the polling from all the liberal news outlets said, gee, he's getting from, you know, 57% to 79% support for everything that he talked about. Every single subject, economic, border, everything else. And you think, that's not division. That's where if you've got a president who's got a minimum of two-thirds support or well over majority, but two-thirds all the way to almost 80% support for his policies, that's not a divided America. And I think that scares the daylights out of the Democrats because they say, we got people rallying around this guy, and we can't figure out how to counter it other than by telling people we're not Trump. Well, if you're getting two-thirds to 80% of the country agreeing with Trump, when you tell them you're not Trump, you say, oh, well, that makes it easy. I don't have to vote for you then. Do what?
Well, and if you look at the mandate that, you know, Republicans won this election by, I mean, not only capturing the White House, the president captured nearly 80 million votes, the popular vote. I can't remember the exact statistic, but it was something like he made gains in every single county across the country, if not nearly every single county across the country, with every single type of demographic group. We captured the House, captured the Senate. And the president said it time and time again on the campaign trail. He said, success will unite us. That's what he's delivering. When he said success will unite us, it's actually in the West Wing with a colleague recently. And, you know, we were reminiscing about the idea that every item on President Trump's agenda that he's accomplishing now is something that he promised and a reason why the American people delivered this victory for the MAGA movement. He, president always said, you know, success will unite us. And that's why, again, I really want to emphasize the idea that this is unacceptable. It is unhinged, but it is not even near a large percentage of the country. The large percentage of the country is thrilled by the direction that we are headed in. We're going to have more money in our pockets. We're going to have a safer, more secure border against illegal aliens, against cartels, against gang members, against fentanyl pouring in. We have a ceasefire in the Middle East. He's negotiating with Russia and Ukraine. We saw the successes he had at NATO. I mean, this is a president who's moving at 100 miles an hour to deliver on every single campaign promise.
And it turns out to be very, very popular. Danielle Alvarez is a senior advisor for the Republican National Committee. Danielle, thanks very much. Back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. And in a moment, Spokane's mayor proposes more affordable housing.
If we keep meeting like this, people are going to talk. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. It's a Tuesday. I hope you all had a wonderful Independence Day. Say a prayer and spare a thought for our friends in Texas. They've suffered a terrible tragedy. And I want you to consider today's X poll. Should President Trump bow to pressure from farmers and grant amnesty to many illegal aliens? My answer to that is a big fat no. And if he does decide to do that, and I'll tell you why I think there are people in the mainstream media, people who hate Donald Trump with a passion, who are writing stories suggesting Donald Trump is going to get behind amnesty. What he has said and what his agriculture secretary, Brooke Rollins, has said is we are going to have no amnesty whatsoever. Will they create a work program? Well, even conservatives I know have said, well, if we had a program like the old Bracero program, the one that allowed workers to come in from foreign countries, usually Mexico, do a few months of labor, make what amount to fantastic wages compared to what you make in Mexico. And by the way, let me just give you the context for that. In most states, if you're going to employ somebody in an agricultural job, you have to pay them minimum wage. Well, in many of the West Coast states, that means $15, $16, $17 an hour. That means in a day, you're going to make well over $100. I looked up the average agricultural wage in Mexico right now. And by the way, Mexico makes Guatemala and El Salvador and countries like that look like, Mexico looks very rich by comparison. But they said in the biggest ag exporting states in Mexico, good wages are 4,700 pesos a month. And that's about $200, $250 a month. In other words, somebody who comes in and works an ag job in America, who is from Mexico, is making as much in 2 days of labor at minimum wage what he would have made in 1 month of doing agricultural work in Mexico. So I know there's pressure to try to help out the farmers. Frankly, I think that most of these jobs that are currently done, still done by illegal aliens, and that number is going down dramatically, are being automated out of existence to where picking fruits, picking vegetables, picking grapes, picking all kinds of crops are being done more and more by machines. And at some point, it won't matter how cheap illegal aliens are. Machinery and automation of that job is going to make more sense. The same way as it makes more sense to have somebody come out with a jackhammer and an excavator, say, to take out a bunch of concrete, than hire a whole crew of guys with sledgehammers and shovels. It just doesn't make sense, no matter how cheap the wages are. So, should Trump bow to pressure? I think what's happening is a lot of the mainstream media is trying to translate this and say, well, if he's talking about a worker program, then he must be talking about amnesty. No, he's not. Because we have H-1B visa programs that are both for technical and non-technical kinds of jobs. We've got green card holders who come in and they work and they're allowed to work legally. Having a worker program is not the same thing as amnesty. And Trump's made the point a number of times, go home legally on your own, apply to come in legally, and if we need the labor, then we will call on you. Now, let me tell you something else that people are seriously, I think, misunderstanding. I had somebody that I knew not long ago, in the last week or so, say, well, we don't have enough people to work these jobs. And that's because boomers, people my age, I'm sort of the tail end of the baby boom. I was not at the beginning of the baby boom. I was born in 59. The baby boom ends, I think, in 1964. So there are a few more years of baby boomers. And they are retiring out at about 10,000 people every day. That's about 3.5 million people every year. And you say, well, we don't have enough people to do those jobs. Well, let me put it this way. How many kids graduate from high school or college every year? That's about 3.5 million people. So you have enough in that crowd of people graduating high school, assuming that most of them will have to have a paying job. Most of them are not independently wealthy, and most of them, their parents won't tolerate them living in the basement for the rest of their lives. So you've got 3.5 million coming out of high school. How many people? That's almost 10,000 per day. Almost the same number as boomers who are retiring. So that's a supply of people to do those jobs. The second piece of that is this. We have about 1.2 million people who are coming into the country as legal green card holders every single year. Now, that's another 3,000 people a day. And then most of them, when they become citizens, are allowed to bring in two or three family members. The average is three. And that's another 10,000 people a day. So you have more than enough people coming into the country to be able to work all of those jobs. And many of the least skilled jobs, things like picking crops and that sort of thing, are simply being automated. And that applies to picking fruit and all kinds of other things. So do I think that Donald Trump is under some pressure from the ag community to sign off on illegal aliens? Yeah, I do. And do I think that those farmers should be saved? Well, let me put it this way. If I told you that to make my talk show work, I had to break the law, and not little laws, I mean major laws, and you said, Lars, the only way to make your talk show work would be to break the law, you know, commit crimes, then you shouldn't be doing the show. And I would apply the same logic to agriculture. I'd say, if you're going to tell me that the only way your business model works is if you have an indentured class of illegal aliens that you can work very, very hard and pay very low wages or lower wages than you'd have to pay an American, then you shouldn't be doing it. And I'll remind you, when that Omaha meat plant got raided by ICE just a few weeks ago, the very next day, they had a whole lobby full of people applying for the jobs that had been vacated by the illegal aliens. That's not a bad thing either. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson.
Comes with you on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday. It's my pleasure to be with you, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network, where we provide honestly provocative talk to the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Sadly, the region suffers from what I consider corruption through vote by mail, and of course, foreign registered voters, non-citizens being registered to vote. And I don't think that the Democrats who call the shots in Oregon and Washington, Idaho may be different, but in Oregon and Washington, I think they like that system. I think it has served them well because it has ensured that Republican governors and Republican majorities in the House and Senate do not get elected in the Northwest. And I think vote by mail is a big piece of that. On that note, I want to welcome to the show Dr. Doug Frank. He's a teacher, a chemist, and a mathematician, and he's an expert on the mathematical analysis of election anomalies. Dr. Frank, welcome back.
Well, good to be with you.
So
thanks for having me today.
You did a presentation not long ago in which you made the case that vote by mail is not working right, and the voting systems in Oregon specifically are not voting right, are not working right. Can you share some of that with my audience, please?
Yes, I think the simplest way to think of it is you have some of the dirtiest voter rolls in the country. You have about 105% of your people registered. Healthy voter rolls would have about 70% of your people registered. So if you just think of it that way, every time you hold an election, since you mail ballots to everybody, about one-third of the ballots are going somewhere. Two out of every three ballots are going to real voters, and one-third is going somewhere. So no matter how the election goes, there's always plenty of fluff out there. There's a credit line that anybody who wants to cheat can scrape up what they need and tilt any election in their favor. That's a huge problem. You've lost chain of custody of your ballots. And that's not just a flippant claim. I've been working in your state for years now, and I give people copies of their own local voter rolls, and they're shocked because they see that I'm exactly right. The numbers work. And it's not just me. Judicial Watch is suing you guys, and they filed suit in October. Yep. That your voter rolls are out of compliance with federal and state law. And that case was up for appeal 2 weeks ago. The state was saying, we want this case dismissed, and we're about to hear the ruling on whether it's going to be dismissed or not. But it's kind of argue that you're that you're complying with federal law when you have 105% of your people registered, and that's pretty bad. So as that ruling comes down, we've got a strategy in set up for that. So I can describe that if you like. But
well,
yeah, the problem is that you're sending ballots to people who aren't real voters.
Yeah, and there's no chain of custody. That's been one of my bugaboos since the beginning, because a ballot leaves the elections office by mail, is delivered somewhere, theoretically, to the address of the registered voter. Then if it's not thrown in the trash, it's marked by somebody, and then it's sent back again through the mails, where it may or may not make it back. But nobody has any idea who put their hands on that ballot in the meantime, which would make me immediately suspicious. Did this ballot actually go to Joe Schmo, or did it go to somebody else?
Exactly. And what I do is, when I work with local teams, which I'm doing now in about a dozen Oregon counties, where lots of big news is about to happen in your state, is I give them copies of the rolls, and I help them find such as dead voters. Somebody's been dead for 5 years, but yet somehow we're counting ballots for them. So that proves that this chain of custody is a serious issue. Or somebody that moved to Texas 10 years ago and they're voting in Texas, because I have the voter rolls from Texas, so I can prove they're voting there. But yet somehow a ballot is being cast for them here. And, you know, they're being that 30% that shouldn't be in the rolls anymore. It's very straightforward to find that sort of thing in your state. And it's, sadly, since 1998, you had this vote by mail thing. And that's a huge disaster. You've got a current citizens initiative where you're out there collecting signatures to get rid of vote by mail. I think that's a good effort to do. But the problem with that effort is that you're not going to be voting on it until 2026.
and you'll be voting by mail.
And you'll be voting by mail. And so I tell everybody, you know, you can't fix broken elections with broken elections. So we need a different strategy. And that's what I've been doing. I've been traveling around the state. This is my third time here in the last year. And it's going to be four times in the last year because I'm coming back in September, because so much good stuff has happened here. This is a big moment for Oregon, a chance for Oregon to lead the national effort for election integrity, if you can believe it. This is like a great moment in time.
Well,
I'm glad to be here with
you guys. Let me ask you about another issue, and that's the one that came up last year. And it came up by accident. It did not come up because Secretary of State Tobias Reid found it. It came up because some liberal outfit out of Illinois asked the state of Oregon, how are you keeping foreign nationals from being registered to vote? And the state of Oregon answered their public records request. And the state of Oregon said, oh, we just found, I think it was 600 initially. It later grew to more than 1,700 foreign nationals that they had found that were registered to vote. And then they effectively said, okay, that's it. And we've talked to the Secretary of State about it. And he said, yeah, that's what we found, 1,700, but that's the problem. No problem solved. And I said, but you only checked, I think it was a little over one third. It might have been one half of all the voters. What about the other half? He said, oh, we'll do those over a period of time. So it sounds like they're willing to tolerate, you know, if you find foreign nationals registered to vote in half the voters you check and you don't check the other half, I don't think it's unreasonable to assume you've got at least a few foreign nationals registered and maybe more than you even think.
Yes, the problem is your state systems automatically register people to vote. If you go to the DMV, you're automatically registered. If you get on welfare, if you go to the doctor, or, you know, or a clinic, any government agency that you touch automatically puts you onto the voter rolls. And so if you're not a citizen and you do that, well, guess what? They put you in the rolls. And there are all these systems and it's inflating. And in my presentations, I show people graphs of every county in the state of Oregon. And sure enough, every single county's voter rolls is surging ever since the state took over control of the voter rolls. When I speak to clerks, they all think they're in control of their voter rolls, and I show them that they're not in it. It's like shocking to them. They don't even realize that their office is just a dumb terminal, that the central computer, you know, remember in the old days we used to have a main computer on campuses, and then there were the dumb terminals around the campus. Well, that's the way our elections are run. There's a central computer, and then all the dumb terminals are all the counties. They're not controlling the election. They're just kind of logging into a central control election. That's the problem.
Have you got one more? I mean, are the courts a strategy for solving this problem?
No, that's the right out of the art of war. You never let your enemy choose the battleground, and the courts are their battleground. And even when you start to win in the courts, they just change the rules. So no, the way we're winning, and we are winning, it's pretty exciting, is it's at the county level. We go county by county. We find the fraud in every county, and then the local citizens document that, investigate it, have everything, case numbers. We work with the local sheriffs. You have some really good sheriffs in Oregon, by the way. A lot of states I go to there aren't good sheriffs. You have really good sheriffs here, and they love this strategy because we don't ask them to do the investigations. We do the investigations. We bring them the actual cases of fraud that anybody can verify. And then we say, because the state's out of compliance with state and federal law, our county, we're going to opt out of the state system. We're going to back off and run our own election. And then
that sounds like the great way to solve it. Dr. Doug Frank. Dr. Frank, thanks very much. Glad to be with you. Glad to take your phone calls and emails. 866-HEY-LARS. Coming up, we're going to talk about Jeffrey Epstein. And is the Epstein mystery finally over? I don't think so. It's Lars and...
He's the best investment in talk radio, and it's free. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I got to tell you something. I am not often disappointed by the administration of Donald Trump or the people that he chose for the various positions that staff his cabinet, but I am now. Jeffrey Epstein, I think, got killed. He got murdered because of what he knew. Now, the FBI is insisting, no, he committed suicide. And we've got the video to prove it by showing you a video of an empty hallway. The only problem is the video is missing about a 1 minute of video. And they say, oh, that's easy to understand. But then we find out that having heard for years about the Jeffrey Epstein client list, and it made sense that he had a client list, Jeffrey Epstein was, at the time of his death, a convicted pedophile. He sought sex from children, and he paid money to get it. And then after he died, his madam, or human trafficker, whichever term you want to use, Ghislaine Maxwell, was put on trial for providing children for sex with Jeffrey Epstein. And some of the testimony that sticks in my mind is that Ghislaine Maxwell was on trial. They called one of the girl victims, now an adult woman, and they asked her, what did Maxwell tell you? And she said, well, you would be perfect for Jeffrey and his friends. Now, the next logical question should have been, well, who were some of his friends, number one? Number two, did you end up having sex forced on you by some of his friends, and who are those people? Now, we are led to believe now by Pam Bondi and by Donald Trump, too, that somehow there never was a list, that nobody had written down anywhere electronically or on paper any kind of list of all the various people that obtained sex from children because of Ghislaine Maxwell and the late Jeffrey Epstein. And in fact, I was a bit disappointed today when Donald Trump was asked about it. Now, there are a lot of other things going on in the world. And Trump said, why? Why are you asking?
Are you still talking about Jeffrey Epstein? This guy's been talked about for years. You're asking, we have Texas, we have this, we have all of the things. And are people still talking about this guy, this creep? That is unbelievable.
No, actually, it is believable. And like I said, I'm not often disappointed by President Trump, but this is a disappointment because he says, well, this is for, you've been talking about him for years. Yes, because there are questions in the public mind. What are some of those questions? Well, did Jeffrey Epstein obtain sex for his friends with children as he obtained sex for himself with children? And President Trump said, well, what's going on in Texas right now is bigger.
I mean, I can't believe you're asking a question on Epstein at a time like this where we're having some of the greatest success and also tragedy with what happened in Texas. It just seems like a desecration.
No, you know what bothers me about this? Epstein was very, very wealthy, and he had contact with some obscenely wealthy people, people like Bill Gates and others. And we don't know why that connection was there. We do know that Jeffrey Epstein's contacts with Bill Gates probably led to Bill Gates' divorce from his wife of many decades. She left him in part because of the connections to Jeffrey Epstein, because even after he knew about some of the things that Epstein had been involved in, Gates continued to be involved with the guy. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I wouldn't have got within a mile of that guy if I had known about his background. I never had the, you know, I guess if you'd call it an opportunity to talk to Jeffrey Epstein, but I thought it was significant that he mixed and mingled with lots and lots of powerful people. And some of you might say, well, he also knew Donald Trump. Yes, he bought a membership in the Mar-a-Lago Golf and Country Club in Florida, and then was kicked out by Trump. And the reason he was kicked out was very significant, because he's an adult man at the time, flirting with a 16-year-old girl. And Donald Trump said, I want that guy out. I am kicking him out of this club. Now, he wasn't yet convicted of the crimes he would later be convicted of obtaining sex with children. But when Pam Bondi came in as the Attorney General of the United States under Trump, she was asked, what are you going to do about releasing the Jeffrey Epstein client list? And she's now trying to explain why she said, it's sitting on my desk, ready for review, getting ready to release it. Take a listen to her explanation today.
In February, I did an interview on Fox, and it's been getting a lot of attention because I said, I was asked a question about the client list, and my response was, it's sitting on my desk to be reviewed, meaning the file, along with the JFK, MLK files as well. That's what I meant by that.
Yeah, well, that may have been what she meant by it, but when people asked her, are you going to release the Jeffrey Epstein client list? And it seems impossible to imagine that somebody who worked, Ghislaine Maxwell, apparently who was convicted of human trafficking for supplying children to Jeffrey Epstein, she's now sitting in prison. But why? And Bondi was asked about the Jeffrey Epstein prison video, and Trump said talking about Epstein is a waste of time. A reporter asked, why was there 1 minute missing from the jailhouse tape on the night of his death? And all, you know, President Trump's response was, why are you still talking about this? Well, Bondi had also said that there were thousands of videos that were part of the Jeffrey Epstein investigation. And that led a lot of people to believe, because the guy had cameras all over his house, that there would be information in there that would help lead them to either the victims or the perpetrators or both. And what does she say about those videos now?
And what was on that, there was a minute that was off the counter. And what we learned from Bureau of Prisons was every year, every night, they redo that video. It's old, from like 1999. So every night the video is reset, and every night should have the same minute missing. So we're looking for that video to release that as well, showing that a minute is missing every night.
See, I don't think this is adequate. I don't think the answers to this have come, and yet Donald Trump seems anxious to push this into the background. Now, I know there are plenty of people who hate Trump who think he had some kind of nefarious connection to Epstein. There's absolutely no evidence of that. But Bondi had said in February, the Epstein client list is sitting on my desk right now to review, except no such list, we're told, ever existed, and there were others who went to court. And they asked the courts, order the government to release this client list. And instead of saying, well, there is no client list, there is no such document, the court said, no, you're not allowed to see the document. And the tens of thousands of videos, were told that those were child pornography, but that they did not apparently include any videos of Epstein with children or with child porn. And so the whole thing's getting swept under the rug, and I think it's the wrong thing. Let's go to Art. Hey, Art, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Well, Lars, you were talking about the voting thing with, I'm having an old guy.
Dr. Frank, I want you to get to this before we hit the break.
Okay. The simple fact of the matter is that if we file an official misconduct complaint, 1, 2, and 3, against Oregon, we can get to this.
You can't file it against Oregon. You have to file it against a person. Which person do you want to file?
Well, it would be, okay, you could file it against Tina Kotek, and also to anyone else who we know is involved. And there's a number of
them. No, but what is the official misconduct?
The official misconduct is that the election system is messed up, and it isn't being done appropriately with the vote-by-mail system.
Yeah, the problem is saying, hey, it's messed up, and it's Tina Kotek's fault. If you're going to file an official misconduct, you've got to tell the court, this is what the misconduct was. You haven't done that. I don't think that's going to work.
The Lars Larson Show. To adjust your volume. He's just that loud. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. If you want to dial in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line every time at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our X poll. You'll find the brand new question every day at Lars Larson Show on X. Let me go to John Malcolm, who's vice president of the Institute for Constitutional Government. John, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Lars.
Was I wrong to see, maybe I saw more in the Supreme Court's ruling that reined in some of the lower federal courts and said, knock that stuff off. You don't have the authority to do that. I thought, well, this is great. We finally got the big court slapping down the lower courts and, you know, putting them back in line, except that it turns out there are some folks who think there's a loophole in that. Help me out. Help me understand that one.
Sure. Yeah, there may actually be a couple of loopholes, but it did swat down the go-to method that, you know, activist judges on the lower courts were using to stymie President Trump from implementing his agenda. So what the Supreme Court said is, you know, you want to issue an injunction in favor of the parties in front of you, but that's not good enough. You want to issue an injunction that applies to everybody in the country in all circumstances. You can't do that because there's no common law tradition of that in courts of equity. You know, in jolly old England or during the founding era, Congress has never given you the authority to do that. You can't do that. But the Supreme Court has said there are two other things that lower courts could do. The Supreme Court said you can always give complete relief to the parties that are before you when you enter an injunction. A lot of these cases are being brought by multiple states. So it may be the case that a lower court will say, well, 20 states have sued challenging something the administration wants to do. I think those states deserve to win. In order to provide those states with complete relief, the only way to do that is to have a nationwide injunction. The other thing that they could do is there is such a thing as a class action.
Yep.
It's, you know, there are hoops you have to jump through under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23, but there are judges that have certified nationwide class actions. Now, you have to establish the standards for nationwide class action. If you do, the losing side can immediately appeal that certification. You can't file nationwide class actions on the same issue in multiple jurisdictions. So if a district court, say in Missouri, certifies a nationwide class action on a particular issue, that's where that issue is going to be litigated. It won't be litigated anywhere else. So it's harder to get a nationwide class action. It will be limited to a particular jurisdiction that certifies a nationwide class action. That certification is itself immediately appealable. But if, in fact, the nationwide class action is certified and that certification is upheld, then you will, in effect, get a nationwide injunction in that case.
But most of these folks have not gone through the process to get that class put together, have they?
That's correct. They have just sat there and said, I think you parties before me deserve to win, and I feel so strongly about it that I'm going to hold that my ruling applies everywhere in the country, even to people that have nothing to do with this litigation. That was very abusive. There's no history of that at all, and the Supreme Court rightly slapped that down.
Well, in fact, John, I mean, there seems to be quite a fight going on, and tell me if I'm overinterpreting this one, because the judge in Boston who got slapped, it was a Boston or Massachusetts, got slapped down, and the Supreme Court said, nope, you don't have the authority, and we're basically vacating, that may not be the right term, but they're negating his entire ruling. And he immediately turned back around and ordered the enforcement of the ruling that the Supreme Court had just gutted, which I also don't think fits with the rules, does it?
Yeah, so that wasn't a nationwide class action, but you had a judge named Brian Murphy, district court judge in Massachusetts, who entered a stay saying the Trump administration wanted to deport some people to South Sudan. And he entered an order saying, you can't do that. And then the Supreme Court, he entered that order in April, and then in May he issued a tweak or a clarification of that order. The Supreme Court got the case and stayed that April order, essentially overruling it, went back to Judge Murphy and said, well, okay, maybe my April order was stayed, but my order in May, which tweaked, wasn't stayed. Therefore, you still can't send these people to South Sudan. And the Supreme Court, the administration immediately appealed, and by a 7-2 vote, the justices Sotomayor and Jackson dissenting, they said, no. Once we stayed your order, your little clarification or tweak did not change the circumstances on the ground. You have to comply with this. And now he has. There's another district court judge in Massachusetts that also done something crazy, which is that, you know, Congress just passed the one big beautiful bill and President Trump signed it.
Signed on the 4th of July.
Yeah, in there is a provision that says that no federal money can go to Planned Parenthood for a year. And a district court judge has just entered a temporary restraining order saying, nope, You have to continue to spend that money, and you have to continue to give it to Planned Parenthood. It is ridiculous.
Is that the federal courts believing that they are the Congress? Because last time I checked the Constitution, it says the Congress can appropriate money, and if Trump signs the appropriation or if they override a veto, if he vetoed it, the money can get spent. But the courts don't get to decide that, do they?
That is exactly correct. So here you have a district court judge that said, I'm going to take a statute. Congress has the taxing and spending authority, and I'm going to overrule that, and I'm going to force them to appropriate money that they have now no longer appropriated. And he sat there and said, this would be a bill of attainder, which is basically a punishment that applies to one party, here being Planned Parenthood. This isn't a punishment. This is a taxing and spending clause. There's no penalty against Planned Parenthood other than the fact that they used to get federal money, and now they won't. It is an outrageous order. I expect the administration will immediately take an appeal. And if the First Circuit won't slap it down, I expect the Supreme Court will, and in short order, too.
Hey, John, I'm talking to John Malcolm from the Institute for Constitutional Government. Can you give me like a 30,000-foot level view of, you know, when Trump came in, they immediately began suing him. But my impression is he's been winning more of them than he's losing. And all this is effectively a delay tactic, because even the people involved in this stuff know that the rulings aren't going to hold up, but they'll hold up for a while.
Well, there was a real liberal judge now passed away named Stephen Reinhardt on the Ninth Circuit who used to get his rulings overturned all the time. And someone asked him why he kept issuing them. And his response was, well, they can't catch them all. And so, yes, the Trump administration is losing at the trial court level from all of these actions that are being filed in these deep blue states. But they have a pretty good track record, not 100%, but they've got a pretty good track record once those cases make it up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's been staying a lot of those lower court rulings and allowing the administration to do exactly what it wants to do, whether it's deporting people or giving access to DOJ, to records, or ending DEI programs, or firing people who are heads of so-called independent agencies. The administration's got a pretty good track record so far. Now, these are all cases that are still going to continue to be litigated at the lower courts, but the status quo is going to be that the administration gets to do what it wants to do. And these are sort of giving a bit of a foretaste about the cases that the Supreme Court will take up on the merits next term.
Well, and John, I did a little deep reading over the weekend, not much, but I was looking at that South Sudan case, and they said there's nothing in the law. I mean, the law allows the U.S. government to deport somebody to the country of origin, and if they won't take him, and some countries won't, you can send him somewhere else. And you don't get your pick. You don't get to say, I want to go to Tahiti. You get to be sent wherever the U.S. government will send you, where the government there will accept you, correct?
That is exactly correct. And there's some people who don't want to go to South Sudan. I wouldn't want to go to South Sudan if they're going to deport me. But, you know, there you go. You don't get to choose where you go to.
No, you don't. That's John Malcolm from the Institute for Constitutional Government. John, thanks very much. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. It's a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
When he talks, you have no choice but to listen. More with Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday. I got to share a couple of thoughts on this because every once in a while a story really gets under my skin. And in this case, it has to do with what else these days? Another illegal alien here in the Pacific Northwest. That was one. The other one was the Seattle shooting where the lady's house got shot up because she had some Trump signs and apparently some Make America Great Again signs and at least one Confederate flag. And somebody went by and shot a bunch of rounds into her house. I mean, very, very dangerous behavior, criminal behavior. And let's hope that they catch the people involved. That's where those Ring doorbells actually might come in handy. But then I saw this story, and it's from the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper. That's the what remains of the Oregonian or Oregon Live newspaper that was once a very large newspaper owned by the wealthy Newhouse family out of New York. These days, a much, much smaller newspaper and not nearly so influential. But the headline just kills me. ICE arrested him in Oregon. His 24-year-old fiance wonders what will happen to their toddler. And I just thought, I've got to read this story because there is so much wrong with that. Number one, just a couple of thoughts. So you got engaged to and then created a child with somebody who's an illegal alien. Does that sound like a good life strategy? And now you're complaining because your law-breaking fiancé has been arrested, which is what I would ordinarily expect to happen with people who break the law. When you break the law, at some point, you're going to get arrested. And I thought about this. The newspaper playing this boo-hoo. Now, this is under the leadership of Therese Bottomley, who's the current editor, although I think she leaves at the end of this month. I don't know if that means that the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper is going to get better or worse. It could be either one. But it occurred to me, there are American citizens who break the law. Do you know what happens when you're an American citizen and you have kids and you break the law? When you get arrested, you are separated from your kids. They don't go to prison with you. In this case, this Pablo Morales character is going to get sent back to Mexico. He's being held until he's deported. Should we, in the view of the fish wrapper, treat illegal aliens better and differently than we treat American citizens? I mean, if somebody's out there robbing banks or making, you know, selling fentanyl or whatever it is they're doing that's breaking the law, they're going to be arrested. Say it's even a white-collar crime like embezzlement. At some point, you're going to get caught, you're going to get arrested, and guess what? You're going to be separated from your kids. And yet this woman is saying, I'm an American citizen. My child is here. My husband's being deported. Well, I guess your child is going to have a very long-distance relationship with daddy, unless, of course, he sneaks back in, as so many illegal aliens do. But she seems to be suggesting that because of the political nature of being an illegal alien, that somehow her husband, or sorry, fiancé, should have been treated dramatically differently than any other law-breaking American would be treated, except he's not an American. Number two, the liberals tell us that illegals only want to work the jobs that Americans don't work. You know, kind of scut work jobs that don't pay well. They're filthy, they're dirty, they're physically difficult. Well, the fact is, an awful lot of Americans work physically difficult jobs. They generally pay pretty well. So what kind of job was Pablo Morales working at when ICE came to pick him up? He was working in construction. Now, I've got family members in construction who are Americans, by the way, who tell me that construction pays reasonably well. I mean, you might have to stay in it for a couple of years until you can get to the journeyman level. But if you're a good carpenter, if you're good with pouring or finishing concrete, insulating houses, putting roofs on houses, people get paid well for that. That these are the jobs that Americans don't want, the one that Pablo Morales was working. So why was Pablo Morales taking a job that, number one, doesn't belong to him? He has no right to be working the job to begin with. And then it should have been going to an American, and it pays well. Pro tip to young ladies, don't get engaged to lawbreakers who might get sent south at any moment. And shame on the Portland Oregonian. You know, the fact is OregonLive.com and Therese Bottomley are telling these boo-hoo stories on a regular basis. And I just wonder whether or not the reporters, it ever occurs to them to say, well, maybe this guy was taking a job that should have gone to an American. Maybe this guy should have come to America legally. Instead, all it is, oh, we're so sorry. Daddy, who's a lawbreaker, is being separated from his little kid. Not a good idea. Last one. Shame on the Vancouver City Council. Clark County Today had a story, and we've followed this one on the air. There's a group called Save Vancouver Streets. And what are they trying to do? What they found is the city of Vancouver has been voting, and Portland does the same thing. They will take a street that is two lanes each way, say two lanes east and two lanes west, and they will chop an entire lane off the street and turn it into either walkways, seating for restaurants, bicycle paths, all kinds of things. Now, the people who are driving cars on that street paid for that street. You could say the city of Vancouver paid for it, but it was actually the citizens who use it who pay the registration fees, the car tabs, the gasoline and diesel taxes. They're the ones who actually paid for the street. So this group, Save Vancouver Streets, went out, gathered 6,500 signatures. Well, we finally got a court decision. And the bottom line on it is the city has gone to court and said the citizens have no right to vote on what we do to their streets. Now, think about that for a moment and then tell me again about representative government, where the government says to the citizens, you got no business telling us what to do. We tell you what to do. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.